This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
I'm also really excited about this study that we're going to start this morning. We've entitled it The Essential Jesus. Let me tell you real quick and dirty what this is about. You know, last winter, we spent several weeks studying the birth of Christ, about five, I think. And then in the late winter, we spent 3 or 4 weeks studying the death of Jesus, in conjunction with Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion. And this series is going to study the life of Jesus between those. We're not going to study the birth of Christ. We're not going to study the death of Christ extensively. We're mainly going to study what's been called the public ministry of Jesus. That roughly 3-year period, beginning in the late 20s AD and ending in the very early 30s AD, in which this man, Jesus of Nazareth, emerged as a rabbi, a teacher, first in the northern part of Palestine, which was called Galilee, but increasingly his influence was felt in Judea, the southern part of Israel, and the capital city, Jerusalem. This short three-year period, which has left such an undeniable influence on the rest of human civilization. We want to look at what this man was like. We want to take a look at the teachings that he gave. What was it about his teachings that had the kind of impact that they had? We want to look at his miracles, and especially the relationship between his miracles and his teachings. We want to look at his strategy of calling individuals and investing intensely in a few who would carry on his work after he departed. We want to look at the conflict that occurred very early on between him and the religious leaders of Israel. This conflict, which was primarily over his claims about himself, and the escalating nature of this claim, which culminated, of course, in his execution. What was it about this Jesus that caused such a polarizing situation in Israel? What was it about this man and his teaching that has sent a shockwave down through not just Western history, but global human civilization since then? We want to look especially at the key events in Jesus's public ministry and in the key themes that he emphasized. Now, in doing that, today will be the only teaching in which we don't actually look at specific texts that cover his miracles or his teachings or whatever. But today is an intro. And in giving an intro to this subject, we really do have to ask the question, which Jesus are we going to study? And I want to be very explicit in my answer to this question. Who is the real Jesus? Each and every teaching that I give on this subject is going to be rooted in the biblical portrait of Jesus. That is, the portrait of Jesus given to us by those four biblical authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that are the first four books of the New Testament. This portrait of Jesus, as you either know or will find out, presents him not confused about who he was, like the Jesus of Jesus Christ Superstar, who do people say that I am so that I can know who I am, but a Jesus who was very conscious of his own identity as a unique and sole savior for the human race, as the sole Messiah or king or rightful ruler over humanity, as the one in whom the predictions of the Old Testament prophets for over 1,000 years found their fulfillment. That Jesus, the Jesus of the four Gospels. But we have to, today especially, we have to raise the question, but is this the real Jesus? Is this portrait of Jesus one that's trustworthy? Or is it a fabrication? Was Jesus hijacked by these men and other people for their own personal agendas? On what basis do we give the biblical Jesus the position of privilege rather than the other Jesuses or other portraits of Jesus that are given to us by different written accounts, different gospels, especially in the last 10 years, first really because of the adept use of the media by the Jesus Seminar, who give us a very different portrait of Jesus, but especially over the last year or so through the Da Vinci Code, a runaway bestseller. I got a chance to read it this holiday season, and it is a delightful thriller. It's a page turner. I think bugging my wife to some extent because I kept leaving to go read more in the book. And I had such an internal conflict emotionally as I read the book on one level, reading it as a novel, just excited to want to know what comes next. And at the same time, to be very frank, a sense of anger. A sense of anger, not just because a different portrait of Jesus was presented, but because of the way in which that portrait of Jesus was defended and the biblical portrait of Jesus attacked. And yet this is a book that evidently resonates with millions of people in America. There is, in the spiritual atmosphere of our culture today, a growing, shall we say, uncertainty at best about who could ever really know what the real Jesus was anyway. This is 2,000 years ago. At best, a growing sense of uncertainty, or more probably a growing sense of cynicism about the biblical portrait of Jesus. And so we have to address this question as foundational before we study in a positive way Jesus. Why not the Jesus portrayed by the Da Vinci Code? Now, for those of you who, you know, to your shame, have never yet read this book, let me just summarize for you briefly the portrait that's presented here. As a fictional work, and yet Dan Brown is drawing directly from the work of the feminist scholar Elaine Pagels, The Gnostic Gospels. Here's the portrait that emerges, that Jesus, the real Jesus, was a prophet in some sense, a mystic in some sense, but never claimed to be the divine Son of God in any unique way. That this was a portrait foisted upon him, actually, centuries later by other people. That what then did Jesus teach? What kind of spirituality did he advance? Well, he espoused the Da Vinci Code, a pagan form of spirituality, a spirituality that advocates the worship of the sacred feminine, that is very similar to pagan fertility cults in which spiritual enlightenment is developed in part through sexual intercourse. So it's a very different portrait. And frankly, right here, I think I have one reason why it's so popular in America. This Jesus was romantically involved with Mary Magdalene. This Jesus married her, sired a daughter by her, who then began the true bloodline of the real Jesus. This Jesus wanted Mary to be the leader of his church after he departed. This was the real Jesus, and the original followers of Jesus understood this, wrote their accounts of the real Jesus, but then they were, and in a very postmodern sense, they lost power, and those who gain power, of course, have the power to rewrite history to advance their own agenda. According to the Da Vinci Code, when Constantine, the Roman emperor, converted around 312, really, AD, he made Christianity the official religion of Rome in 325 AD, Constantine, according to the book, and there may be some substances. I'm not at all convinced that Constantine was a true Christian, but the point, the theory advanced is that he wanted Christianity to be the Roman Empire's religion because he saw that it was on the rise and that he could use it to advance his own and solidify his own power. To that end, he convened a council. And in that council, through his power, essentially, he made sure that the over 70 other gospels of Jesus, some of whom contained the real portrait, were rejected by that council, and that the four that were selected were the four that helped his version of Christianity, which would facilitate his political agenda. As I say, it's a very postmodern spin. And that since then, the New Testament has been copied, recopied, translated, revised, edited, altered in various ways to such an extent that we can't really know what the New Testament taught about Jesus anyway, even though it's not the right portrait to begin with. Now, this is bringing together themes and questions and doubts that have been below the substructure in American thinking now for decades. And I think that's why so many people resonate with this novel. What I want to do as we begin this series is to give just a very brief response to the portrait of Jesus in the Da Vinci Code, and simultaneously to provide some reasons for why the Jesus of the four Gospels is the correct portrait, the real Jesus. And folks, I don't want you to take my word for it. There's lots of good information on this, but I want to tell you that when it comes to figuring out which the real Jesus is, this is not a crapshoot. This is not some sort of thing where, you know, we just have fragmentary bits of information, and so it's, you know, maybe 51% toward this portrait, and that, you know, it's so uncertain that we just might as well embrace the portrait of Jesus that services our own psychological needs best, because that's the best that we're going to do, to have construct our own therapeutic Jesus. It's not even close. The evidence is overwhelming that the New Testament portrait of Jesus is the accurate historical portrait. Let me give you some reasons why I say that. Why the biblical Jesus? First of all, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are by far the earliest records of Jesus's life. Mark was probably written around 55, as early as 55 AD. Jesus died in 30 or 33 AD. Mark was written by 55 or 60 AD. The latest of the four Gospels, John, was written by 90 AD. They're first century documents. When I came to Christ almost 35 years ago, there was still a lot of liberal scholarship that was trying to defend the case that the Gospels were written in the second century. And it was the faith of the second century church written back into history. That's long ago been dropped. It's virtually universal. Universally understood on the basis of the hard evidence that these are first century documents. Why is that important? Because when you're trying to learn about a historical person or event, the closer your documents are to the person or the event, the more reliable the information that you have about it. Conversely, the farther away from the event or person the original documents were composed, the less reliable they are. By contrast, the other so-called Gospels, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, and there are indeed many Gospels of Jesus, mostly written by a sect known as Gnosticism, which had a well-documented habit of rewriting history and alleging that the documents were authored by leaders, authoritative leaders. It's called pseudonymous literature. We know that none of these Gospels was composed any earlier than 150 A.D. Several decades, close to a century after the original four Gospels. And most of them are written far later than that. Most of them are second and even third century documents. Not only that, but these accounts are eyewitness accounts. And whenever we study history, it's well understood that eyewitness accounts are the very best kind of historical evidence that we can have, just as they are in courtroom. Matthew was the Matthew of Jesus's 12 disciples, as was John. Mark wrote the memoirs of Peter. We know that on very good authority that Mark's gospel is Peter's account of what of the ministry of Jesus. Luke tells us that he wrote his two work account, Luke and Acts, and especially the first account of Jesus's life, by interviewing eyewitnesses of the events that he tells us about. They have the flavor of an eyewitness account. You'll read an offhand comment in Mark about where he mentions that when Jesus fed the 5,000, the grass was green. The grass is green in that part of northern Palestine only for a couple of months a year. It's exactly the kind of casual comment that an eyewitness makes. They read so very differently than mythical or legendary literature, and I'll say more about that in a moment. The Gospels don't sanitize, the authors don't sanitize their own mistakes. Now, that is something that will call into question an alleged eyewitness account when the one writing the account always comes out like a superhero. You can't read Mark's Gospel. You can't read any of the four Gospels and possibly come away with the impression that the people who wrote them were heroes. They're knuckleheads. And the very fact that they're so brutally honest about their own failures, their own misunderstanding of Jesus, is precisely the kind of information that corroborates their trustworthiness as witnesses. And of course, we know that they were persecuted, and all, with the possible exception of John, were killed, executed, because of their insistence on this testimony about who Jesus was and what he did. By the way, it's difficult to understand how the Da Vinci Code Jesus or his followers ever got persecuted by the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire spirituality was basically immersed in pagan fertility cults. And it's very difficult to explain how these men who were dishing up the same kind of pagan fertility cult spirituality became so unpopular in a culture that loved that kind of spirituality. No, they were teaching a totally different kind of spirituality that polarized their culture. And they died for their testimony. Our word martyr comes from the Greek word marturion, which means witness. They sealed their witness with their blood. Eyewitnesses who don't sanitize their own account and who are willing to die for their testimony are about the best kind of historical evidence that it's possible to have. We know that these men not only tell the story of Jesus, and they don't tell it in a legendary or mythical way. C.S. Lewis, for example, reading the Gospels as a literary critic, as an atheist, realized, he said, I know what myth is like. I know what legend reads like. And I know the Gospels are neither legend nor myth. They are written as history, as historical narrative. One of the features of historical narrative is that they make deliberately connections between their person and other historical events and people, and in the context of space and time, complete with chronology. They're all the time linking their message to history. And of course, that makes them vulnerable to being discredited. Because if we can check their historical references according to other known historical facts and find that they get it wrong most of the time, then we have no basis for trusting what they're teaching us about. By the way, some people say, well, it's historical fiction. Historical fiction as a literary genre didn't even begin until the last century, 20th century. There's no such thing as historical fiction in the first century. They're writing history. And, over the last 20 years, some very good minds have dedicated large portion of their lives to exposing and making use of this vulnerability of the New Testament by saying we're going to prove that these authors make all kinds of errors historically, so we can't trust what they say about their main figure. One man that you may have heard of in this regard is a man named Sir William Ramsay. He was one of the leading experts in a relatively new discipline of archaeology. And Ramsay knew about Luke, Luke's accounts. He knew about Luke's frequent references to people and places in the first century Roman world. He knew that Luke in Acts 13 mentions that Sergius Paulus was the Roman proconsul in the island of Crete. And he knew for a fact that Sergius Paulus was never proconsul of Crete. He went to Crete, excavated the Roman governmental building, found the cornerstone on which it was inscribed, constructed when Sergius Paulus was proconsul of Crete. And this began a whole excavation tour of Ramsay as he excavated site after site mentioned in Acts and then later in Luke. And this was his verdict. You need to realize that the other gospels, so-called, either have no historical narrative at all. For example, the Gospel of Thomas is not a gospel because it has absolutely no historical narrative. It's a series of 114 disconnected sayings of Jesus. One of which has Jesus saying that women, unless they become men, can never enter into the kingdom of heaven. But more importantly, in this regard, they don't have any historical references to check. The other gospels are either blatantly non-historical or clearly legendary or mythical in the way that they're written. Ramsay, at any rate, said, Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect of its untrustworthiness. In other words, unsurpassed in terms of first century historians. Luke is a historian of the first rank, and not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, but he says this author should be placed along with the very greatest of the historians in the first century. And this man wasn't just playing an academic game to entertain himself. When he realized this was the case, he took seriously Luke's portrait of Jesus, and he committed his life to Jesus as his Savior, as his King, and devoted the rest of his life to defending the trustworthiness of the Gospels and the New Testament archaeologically. You know, in the Da Vinci Code, again, one of the statements is that the New Testament, you know, did not arrive as a fax from heaven. It's a thoroughly human document. It's been edited, copied, translated, revised, altered so many times over the centuries that we can't possibly know what was originally written anyway. You know, that is so patently false. The truth is that there is absolutely no other ancient document whose composition has been preserved better than the New Testament. I mean, it's not even close. The other pseudo-gospels we have a few, and the reason why this is important is, this is called textual criticism. It's charting the transmission of an ancient text. And the two canons of textual criticism, the main canons are, one, do we have enough copies of the original that we can compare them to each other? Because by comparing the copies with each other, we can identify inadvertent scribal errors or hijacking and editorial alterations. And do those copies go back close enough to the originals that we're back there close enough that we can chart the history of the transmission of that text? Now, the pseudo-gospels, in their cases, we have a few, at most a few ancient copies of these works. And except with one or two exceptions, most of the copies are fully 1,000 years after the originals were written. That's not bad in terms of ancient documents. That's not bad at all. That's the norm. For example, the Roman historian Tacitus, first century historian, wrote a history of the Roman Empire called the Annals. And we have 20 ancient copies of the Annals, the earliest one of which goes back to, is 1,000 years after the Annals was written. And no one seriously doubts that what we have matches what he wrote. When we turn to the New Testament, including the Gospels, we have a very different animal altogether. We have over 5,000 ancient copies of the New Testament, and the earliest copies go back to within 150 years after the originals were composed. We have fragments, for example, a fragment of the Gospel of John, a papyrus fragment that everyone acknowledges is authentic, found in Egypt, dated to 125 AD, which means that that copy was written within about 40 years of the time that John wrote it. This is unique. The great irony is that we live in a culture that commonly just gulps down the idea, oh yeah, it's been written and copied, so we can't know what they said. We're sitting on top of the ancient work that we can know above better than any other work. This is what it said. It's been accurately translated. It's almost a conspiracy. It's almost a divine conspiracy. It's almost as though God went out of his way to make sure that this work was transmitted and preserved properly so that we could know. One last comment on this subject. You know, again, I said that the Da Vinci Code is a postmodern work because, and I want to be careful how I say this, anyone who knows human history and anyone knows history does know that people in power tend to use their power to marginalize others and to perpetuate their own power. And we know that people are not above rewriting history to advance their own political agenda. That's called propaganda. Anyone who's familiar with the Nazi regime or the Stalinist era of Russia knows how integral propaganda rewriting history was to those regimes to keep them in power. The idea here is more cynical, though, that if people have an agenda for the history that they're writing, if they have a personal commitment to the events or the people that they're writing about, by definition, they're untrustworthy. We can't trust what they're saying. They must be distorting the picture. That's cynical postmodern thinking. It's simply not true. Here's an example that I found in the Dispatch last year as the Passion came out. This was from a rabbi here in Columbus who said, yes, the story of Jesus is historical. There was a Jesus. But the way it's captured in the canonical Gospels is religious history, not pure history, and there is a difference. Religious history is there to try to evangelize, if you will, to try to teach a particular faith belief. It's not to tell you what happened. You see, the dichotomization, if they're trying to promote a belief, by definition, it's not about telling you what happened. Now, that is a totally cynical perspective. Compare that to this statement by Craig Blomberg, a very solid New Testament scholar. Simply because a writer is passionately committed to promoting a particular cause doesn't at all mean that he or she will falsify the facts. Often, such a person will work all the harder to tell the story straight. Because after all, often the truthfulness of something is what produced the personal commitment in the first place. You want two examples? Jewish historians' history of the Holocaust. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. By whom were these histories written? They were written by people with a profound conviction and personal agenda about which they're very upfront. The Jewish historians of the Holocaust are writing so that that will never, ever happen again. Solzhenitsyn wrote the Gulag Archipelago to prevent, if possible, the emergence of any kind of Stalinist nightmare again. Who in our culture today brings into question the factuality of Jewish historians of the Holocaust because they have an agenda? I doubt seriously that the rabbi that made this comment would apply the same standards to his Jewish brothers and sisters who have written so passionately about the Holocaust. We don't determine whether a work is historically reliable by whether or not the authors had an agenda. All ancient histories were written by people who had an agenda. We determine whether they're reliable by whether or not they fit, whether or not they can answer the questions we just talked about there. Are there enough copies? And are the copies go back early enough that we can tell what they even wrote? As they interface with history, do they tell the truth or are they demonstrably false? Are there eyewitness accounts? Are they the earliest accounts? That's how you determine historical reliability. And so this is a very cynical perspective that, it's just not fair. It's hypocritical. I said earlier that when it comes to whether or not we can know, whether or not we can know the real Jesus, whether we can know about him, that this is not a crapshoot. This is not just some roll of the dice because the evidence is so confusing and so contradictory and so even-handed that we finally just have to, you know, make a commitment. It's not that way. Even non-Christian historians like these two men say, we know more about Jesus than almost any other first century Jew. And they're talking about the Jesus of the Gospels. The other Jew that they say we can know more about is the Apostle Paul, because we have even more eyewitness and firsthand literature about him than Jesus. God wants you to know. God went out of his way so that you can know who the real Jesus was, so that you can make an informed decision about how you will respond to him. And a responsible decision. That's why, from here on out, I'll be working unapologetically from the actual passages in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. Now, let's just take the few minutes that we have left this morning and shift gears. And, you know, obviously, I want to pose the question, who was this real Jesus? If we can know that this is the accurate portrait, then what is he like? What was it about this person that so fascinated his followers, that elicited such a commitment from them that they died for their commitment to him? Even in the Gospels themselves, this is the question that comes up very early on. Who is this guy? Well, that's what, of course, the rest of the series is going to be about, just scratching the surface of this question. I wanted to share with you, though, an observation that has struck me. By the way, I have to say, you know, personally, all my life I've been afraid of being bored. And my mom will tell you the problems that that caused. That is some of the problems that she knows about that it caused. But truly, when I came to Christ at the age of 17, one of the earliest things that I tripped over was, what am I going to do when this gets boring? And I just have to say, for what it's worth, that, you know, I have never found Jesus boring. Jesus is the most intriguing person that I have, by far the most intriguing person I have ever discovered. And even my fears of boredom in eternity have been put to rest since I realized that most of what I'll be doing is getting to know this person better. One of the things about Jesus that is most intriguing to me is the way in which in him characteristics that are normally mutually exclusive with people come together with him. And I'll show you what I mean in just a second. Normally people are either, if they're this way, then they're not this way. And in Jesus, over and over again, these characteristics that are either or for most of us come together in him in the most amazing and intriguing way. Let me give you some examples. First of all, you get to know this Jesus in the Gospels, and you'll see, for one thing, that his moral demands are disturbingly high. Oh my gosh. And we're going to be looking at an example of his ethical teaching in a few weeks. I mean, his bar for what righteousness is just goes way higher than anything we frankly want to imagine. This was one of the main reasons why the religious leaders hated him, is because his ethical teaching condemned them as sinners. Now, we know some people who have high moral standards, right? And a lot of us know people who have seemingly real high moral standards. And we usually call those people, like, you know, holier than thou, self-righteous people. The thing that's amazing about Jesus is that while his moral standards are amazingly high, the breadth of his mercy was shockingly wide. The people who considered themselves the most righteous in his culture hated him because he convicted them as sinners. The people that the righteous people had written off as irredeemable lost causes, they flocked to Jesus because they sensed in him mercy that they'd never experienced before. How does he do that? How does mercy that wide come together with righteousness that high? Now that's a question worth pondering. On the one hand, Jesus claimed to be from another world. And frankly, when you read the Jesus of the New Testament, do you hear him saying almost casually, well, you know, my father sent me here. I didn't come of my own accord. And I'm going to be going back to where I came from soon. And, you know, I'm not of this world. You see why some of these novels that say that, you know, he's E.T. that was dropped off by a UFO. You see why they sell some copies, because there's an otherworldly bearing about Jesus that's very strange. And yet at the same time, he was not at all otherworldly in his dealings with people. In fact, just the opposite. It was the common people who flocked to him, in part because he was so intensely familiar with their lives. His favorite way of teaching was by parable, in which he illustrated spiritual truths through the use of describing common, ordinary, everyday events in their lives. He was a carpenter from the working class. People sensed that he understood their world from the inside. But he was thoroughly otherworldly. How does he do that? How does that work? He was clearly a larger-than-life public figure. I mean, from the very beginning of his public ministry, masses of people flocked to hear him and followed him wherever he went, to such an extent that that became, like other celebrities, a big problem in his life. How do I get away from the crowds? So there's a larger-than-life quality to Jesus. But, you know, most larger-than-life figures have a certain persona in which their persona itself tries to keep them detached and remote from the normal people. That's part of their mystique. You know, Michael Jackson has a larger-than-life persona, whatever you think about him. Those of you from an older generation remember someone like, for example, Douglas MacArthur, who was a larger-than-life figure, military leader, who, you know, just had this majestic bearing behind his sunglasses, and who could say great things like, I shall return. And I mean, he was a great man in many, many ways. Part of his persona was, though, his remoteness and detachment from people. This Jesus is a larger-than-life figure, but who was intensely interested in individuals. He doesn't fit the mold. The same man who was so magnetic to the crowds would interrupt everything that he was doing to talk to individuals, and all kinds of individuals, not just the wealthy or the powerful or the people who could help him. He didn't seem to need anyone's help. That made his interest in the people who couldn't help him all the more remarkable. Undoubtedly, one of the main reasons why these men wrote their accounts was because of Jesus's amazing personal interest in them. Men, women, working class, ruling class, Jew, Gentile, it didn't matter. He loved individuals. Individuals felt comfortable, but simultaneously disturbed in his presence. How did he do that? Why was he that way? That's a fascinating thing to ponder as you read the Gospels. He was completely realistic about human depravity. Do you know what depravity means? It's not a PC word. Depravity means sinfulness, wickedness. And there is not a shred of naive, optimistic humanism in Jesus. Jesus was utterly realistic about the sinful motives and lusts as well as the actions of normal people. At one point, John says the crowds were believing in him because of his miracles, but he wasn't believing in them because he knew what was in the heart of all people. The religious leaders were optimists of a certain sort, humanists of a certain sort, because they said, you know, our problem really is mainly external. We have to live in a world where there are sin cooties transmitted by bad people. And so we have to protect ourselves from the sin cooties of the bad people. And Jesus just called that the BS that it was. He says the real problem is in the heart of every person. Because there in the heart are the lusts and the deceptions and the other sinful motives that corrupt people's souls and set their lives on fire. So he was utterly realistic about the depravity of human nature, and yet there is no trace of cynicism in Jesus. And here's an example of what I'm talking about. We all know rose-colored glasses, optimistic people who aren't realistic. And then, of course, in our culture, the pendulum is swung. We are the Seinfeld-Simpsons culture. We're a culture of cynics. Oh, we know what people are like. So we debunk and deconstruct every noble cause, regardless. It's either that you're optimistic and naive, or you're realistic and you're cynical. And in Jesus, somehow, this utter realism and without any trace of cynicism comes across. Here is one who can look into the heart of people and see the dirt that is there, and yet to be essentially optimistic about every human being, not because of them, but because of the power of God's love to change people's lives if they respond to him. This is the Jesus who met Peter and said, I know that your name, Simon, is the right label for you because Simon means vacillator, unstable. That's what you are. But you will be called the rock, Peter, as you follow me. Don't you, like all of us, long to be known by someone who knows you for what you are, including all of the dirt, but who still loves you as you are and who believes in your potential because of the power of God's love to change your life? And now we're getting much closer to what captured these men's hearts about Jesus. He was single-mindedly focused on his goals. I love that. I'm a goal-oriented person. Yeah, it says in the Gospels, he resolutely set his steps toward Jerusalem, and nothing could deter him from accomplishing his goal in Jerusalem. He says, I accomplish the work the Father gave me to do. And so he's very goal-oriented, very functional in that sense, and yet he never ran over people to accomplish his goals. That's not what I'm like. I'm goal-oriented, and I often run over people, hopefully not intentionally too often, but sometimes intentionally. to accomplish my goals. You just don't see that with Jesus. You see him committed to accomplish his goals, but never viewing people as interruptions. Right in the midst of doing really important things, someone will show up and interrupt, and he's like, wow, cool. And have this conversation with them, in which he gives them his full attention. It's because the God that he followed, the God whose goals he came to fulfill, is a God of loving redemption, who's all about loving people. Frankly, his claims about himself sound psychotic. I mean, try to read the Gospels just looking for his claims. I mean, I'm the Messiah. I'm the unique Son of God. Before Abraham ever was, I always have been. I and the Father are one. He didn't say that to a group of Buddhists who were pantheists. Om, we're all God. He said it to a group of monotheists. He says, I'm the Lord of human history. My return will end human history as you know it. And oh, by the way, the main thing that's going to happen between my first coming and my second coming is that this message about me and what I've done has to be taken all over the world. And then that'll be what brings the end of human history. You know, little minor megalomania comments like that. It's everywhere. And yet at the same time, and people have long noted this, Jesus personifies mental health and sanity. I mean, one of the most amazing seeming paradoxes here is the claims that he makes for himself, but his amazing humility. That's one of the qualities about Jesus that will blow your minds the most, how humble he is. He washes his disciples' feet. Without any sense of moral outrage. His stability in the midst of overwhelmingly stressful situations, most of all his own passion. Not only his demeanor, but his teaching on human relationships. The world basically acknowledges if we could just love one another the way Jesus taught us to love, this world would be a great place. Now look, I've interacted with crazy people and people who claim that they're divine or whatever. And I've watched the way they live and I've listened to what they say, especially about human relationships. And I wouldn't give a quarter for their instruction. I want them to stay on their meds. How is it that this man who made more overt claims for himself of divinity than any other historical figure personifies sanity? How does he do that? These are the sorts of things that I'm talking about when I say that Jesus is the most intriguing character that I have ever met. And it was these sorts of things that drew these men to Jesus. And you know, they write their accounts of Jesus. I might have to say this. Look, they were, I guess they're okay people. But their picture of Jesus is so original, these guys never could have made it up. They're no way near smart enough to make up a character this original. And that's just another thing to think about. How'd they ever come up with someone like this? They wrote about him. Not just because he was a historical oddity, a bug that they pinned on a piece of styrofoam. But they wrote about him because knowing him changed their lives for good. And they wrote about him, they preserved their account of Jesus for people who never saw Jesus, not just so that they could have, you know, a nostalgic sense, oh, I wish I could have been there. I wish I could have known him like these men knew them. They wrote their accounts of Jesus with the conviction that Jesus is still alive. And that people who lived after him can still know him personally. They wrote their accounts as introductions to a living contemporary person. Not just as a historical artifact. So what's John's agenda? He's very straightforward. These things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the unique King, and that the Son of God, and that by entrusting yourself to Him, you may also have spiritual life through Him. That's why they wrote. It is possible not only to know that we have the accurate portrait of the historical Jesus, it is also possible to meet this Jesus personally and to have your life changed by His love. Let me close by asking you to listen with me to Jill and Nathan Briscoe, who share briefly, as two very different people you'll see, just this, how they have met Jesus.
People that professed that the Bible was the Word of God were people who had accepted a simple answer. It was sort of the single religion or spirituality that I had sort of boxed off. I would explore everything else but that. That was the last thing I wanted to be. So at the same time that I was striving to find something, I was also in really a depths of despair. I struggled with depression, drug addiction, various types of sin issues that really controlled me.
I was really insecure. I was really searching for something, some type of meaning, some type of love. I turned to athletics. I was a big time runner and soccer player, and my appearance. So I decided to quit eating and became anorexic. I thought that relationships were important, but I didn't know how to have them. I had never had a deep relationship in my life. I definitely sensed a void in my life. I looked to relationship with food, relationship with drugs, sexual relationships. I equated sex with love, but I never ever was filled more than really even a day. I remember when he said that you can have a personal relationship with God, and explain that God is a personal being, He's a relational being. That's how we are always wanting relationships, and He can teach you how to have relationships. I said, what do you think about this? Kind of needed to run it across another person. And he said, yeah, I did that just the other day. I asked Christ into my heart, and, He can take your burdens from you. He said, you carry the weight of the world on your shoulders. He said, let it go. Let Christ take it. And I started to cry, and I sat down on the bed and asked Nathan to sit with me and hold my hand, and it was the first time that I really felt like I could talk to God, that He understood, that He was there with me.
I understood that I needed forgiveness, that I had lived a life that needed to be forgiven, and I wanted to know more about Christ. And if He, check out His claims to be God. And I knew that the first step was to try to start a personal relationship with God. So I took it on pretty easily. I just, before work one day, I just sat down at the end of the bed and I said a little prayer. This is after going to a couple of home groups and seeing how folks pray, and just said, I need you. I want to know you. Come into my life. Take my burdens, and let's do this. I want to see if your claims are real.
I felt it right away. And I know not everybody does, and that's what people say, that don't expect the heavens to open and a bolt of lightning. But I really felt it, and I felt the world come off my shoulders. I started wanting to relate to people. I started wanting to have friendships. I started seeing the importance and the beauty of honesty in relationships. I'd always thought before that it was, it was my business and it was my body, and nobody needs to know, nobody needs to worry about it, and I would get really aggravated if somebody tried to ask me about kind of my eating habits and my weirdness about it. God put it on my heart that it was just a big ugly lie. And since then, he's really healed me from it.
What Christ has provided for me is an entire unity of life, where there's no longer any separation between the different components that make me up. I don't have to use different thought forms for my regular life, my spiritual life, my emotional life, my intellectual life, my life with Jill. It's all the same now. I take it all to the cross, and it all makes sense. So there's a great sort of calmness, feeling of you know, I can handle anything that comes along because Christ provides the equipment, right? The mental equipment, the emotional equipment. And the best thing of all is he's finally, you know, showing me how to love people.
Wow. That's what I'm talking about when I say that we can not only know accurately who the Jesus of history is, but he's also the most contemporary person in the whole world. We can know him today. And it's as simple as what they said. Calling out to him in your own words, saying, I know I need to be forgiven, and I want you to come into my life and begin a relationship with me so that I can know the love of God. I mean, that's literally as simple as that. So anyway, let me just close with these three quick challenges. Why don't you just, especially if you're here investigating, why don't you join us for this study of Jesus. Get to know the real Jesus in the coming weeks. Why don't you supplement this study by reading for yourself? Dive into the Jesus of the Gospels. Start, I mean, they're not long. They're not nearly as long as the Da Vinci Code. And frankly, they're a lot better. We have, I would say, if you really are kind of new to this, start with the Gospel of John, because John tells us, as we saw, I'm writing to people who don't believe, but who are seeking. And start there and just begin to read. And as you read and as you come out to listen, ask him to reveal himself to you if he's real. Ask him, say, I want to know you. Show me, teach me about you. I think that'd be a very fruitful exercise. I'm not a big New Year's resolution person, but I don't think you could go wrong on that one. At any rate, next week then, we'll take a look at John the Baptist, this man who was, we're told, the last prophet of the Old Testament era, and more than a prophet because he was the fulfillment of prophecy and the one who announced the Messiah. He's a key figure as we study the public ministry of Jesus. Let's close in prayer. Dear Lord, I want to pray for the coming weeks, for this series. Lord, I pray that above all else, we can learn about Jesus, and that you will be at work in our own hearts to whet our appetite and stimulate our curiosity to know you, to know you better, to know you afresh. I pray that for many of us, you would supernaturally erase the grid through which we think about you, because familiarity often breeds boredom and contempt. And we pray, Lord, that we'll be able with fresh eyes to see who you are. And thank you so much that we can not only read about who you were, but we can know you as you are. We praise you for that, and it's in your name that we pray. Amen.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.